The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, December 19th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, if not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Jason Ben Levy with his book, Too Much Magic. Updates on D-17, Occupy, protests over the weekend. Kim Jong-il, we'll check in on his health. Not good, apparently. Mitt Romney's campaign, also not in particularly good health, although better than Newt Gingrich's. But be that as it may, we will take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jason Ben Levy, author of Too Much Magic. Very fascinating take on the problems of our digital age and how, in many respects, Occupy Wall Street broke out of that, even though it relies so much on digital technology to spread the word. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jason Ben Levy. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. On the phone, Jason Ben Levy. He is a author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Technology. And you can get more information on him at his site, jasonbenlevy.com. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. Now, long-time listener.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear that. Now, Jason, tell me, let's start first with your background. You've been involved in the digital media for years.
Right. I'm one of those kids who was meant to be a science kid during the 60s and during the space age, and pretty much a contemporary of Jobs and Bill Gates. And, you know, back when we started, computers were big, hard things to use. And then kind of hippie science came along and computers became things that the rest of us could use. And we got to be able to do creative things with it. Like starting your own radio show or publishing your own book or, you know, all the great things that we were able to do with digital technology.
And but now you perceive that it's there's an element of this that is problematic. I mean, you write that the same aspects about digital life that we appreciate are also problematic.
Right. One of the problems is, well, you know, again, when we started and we had our own individual computers, we were pretty well empowered to do things ourselves. And we like the idea of the internet being the thing that connects us all together. But it kind of changed the nature of both Silicon Valley and digital life when we started being able to connect things together. You know, when we think about most technologies, there's like a dark side and there's a positive side. And we always get sold the positive side of the technology first. If you think about plastics, what a miracle they were. And now they're, you know, filling our oceans with crap we can't get rid of. So many different technologies, this happens. With digital technology, we've managed to connect everyone together. But the problem is, the problem we always have, which is the people in control of us, in control of it, giving us the positive side of the story, are usually making a lot of money telling us that positive side of the story. And they usually neglect to tell us what the downsides are. Well, when it comes to digital technology, our downside is that we've put very few people who are less than 1% in charge of all of this. That is, that we can't do our radio shows and our doing our various social network stuff without one or two companies holding it all together.
Well, so what is problematic about that? I mean, you know, when we say like, what is the, be more explicit as to, like, you know, what companies are you talking about and exactly what is the concern? Because I know that your critique is broader than the idea of privacy. It is, it's,
right.
What is problematic about those having that control there? Is that it's driving it's driving the instruments in a wrong direction or what?
It's a combination of two things. It's a sociological thing in driving the instruments in the wrong direction, making us extremely dependent on them to the point that people in their 20s often cannot manage to do things without the technology. So they're becoming very reliant on it, and that leaves them vulnerable to manipulation in terms of depending upon that resource. That is, it's very hard for people when we look at Facebook, which is a great utility, it's really a data collection service. It's not, you know, we're not the customers, we're the product. And there's a lot of data collection that happens about us, but also it changes the way we behave with each other. It changes the way we occupy physical space. We no longer have the same kind of intimate connection in physical spaces. So, like, Sam, go to any cafe in New York, and you'll see two people sitting across from each other, both with their laptops open. And if you went to a cafe 15 years ago, people would be talking to each other.
Yeah, so it's twofold. I mean, I have to say, like, I have mixed feelings about some of your critique. But let's start with the dependency, because I do think the dependency thing is something that does really, you know, it does scare me a little bit. Because, and in fact, you know, I found at my dad's house, you know, a series of the old encyclopedias and world books. And he was going to chuck them, and I was like, you know what? I'm gonna take these and just store them for my daughter in the event that, like, we don't have electricity in 25 years, and she all of a sudden becomes, you know, the sort of the Sarah Connors, because she's the only one with the books. I do think that's somewhat problematic, but if I hear what you're saying too, that part of the problem is that while this technology was to sort of create, make us all independent and more self-sufficient, in some ways that is an illusion, because our self-sufficiency is ultimately tied into one or two key operators.
That's correct. And so if you think about, you know, now we're having the net neutrality argument. And when you realize that when the internet started, there were multiple ISPs, there were multiple companies that you could go to get yourself connected to the net, and they were all independent, and it was something you had some sort of choice in. Now, in most cities, people are down to one company to connect them to the internet. And those companies have their own political agenda. It's not really an odd coincidence that Comcast, as an example, would want to own NBC, which is a major news outlet. And Comcast has a political agenda. And if, and say, you know, where it starts coming into play is that if Comcast decides the Sam Cedar Majority Report is something that they really don't want people finding, it's pretty easy for them to go and hide it.
That's right. I mean, it used to be when it was dial-up, I guess we had literally hundreds of different ways in which you would connect to the internet. I mean, it was all the same way, but different providers of that entry point. Go ahead.
Yes. Now, you know, the way to approach this would be to really have a true public utility, which is to have, you know, a bandwidth basically as a public utility, just like we have highways, and just let people connect with their own individual local companies of choice. So that way they weren't subject to having a company like AT&T or Verizon, which basically was plug the NSA into the switches and gave them full access, and then those companies received complete immunity for whatever they did.
So part of your critique is the consolidation of and our sort of the lack of reliance that we have on a couple of entities for access to this information that we've become so reliant upon. And then the other critique is sort of the way in which it is affecting socialization.
Absolutely. And that they're tightly linked. That is, that the more dependent we are on these resources, the more money the people who own those resources make. And the less able we are to do things ourselves, again, it drives us back to that same thing. that we're more dependent on them and spending our money with them. And again, when you look at the venture capitalist and their ties into companies like Goldman's, and even how the first dot-com bubble was really the bubble before the real estate bubble with a lot of the same players, we get this the same kind of tizzy effect happening, that we foam people up about the excitement of the new technology. And in fact, a lot of it really is exciting, but the agenda beyond that is somewhat more nefarious.
That being just simply profit.
That being a problem, right. And digital tools, you know, we have an ability to do a lot of reality distortion with digital tools. When we think about how the same tools that we're using to watch movies that with special effects are starting to find their way into the news, and there's really nothing stopping the news from becoming a good deal of falsehood, where we can no longer believe the pictures that we see.
And you wrote a piece in Common Dreams where you said you hold the view that, contrary to being a product of social media, and I'm not sure if that's necessarily, and that may be the conventional narrative, that, you know, that is, it's a function of social media in some way.
Right.
But you hold the view that the Occupy movement results from the shortcomings and dissatisfaction of digital culture. Explain what you mean there.
Sure. So, you know, for the last, you know, decade or less, we've all been blogging and we've all been communicating with each other, and we're all in our own rooms. And certainly on the progressive side, we've been pretty vocal among each other. But then we found the Tea Partiers, who were kind of a faux group. Once they got out in front of the cameras in D.C., they started garnishing a lot of attention. Once they started showing up in meetings and disrupting meetings, people paid attention. And we may have been commenting to each other about it on blogs. And again, I'm a pretty active blogger and engage in a lot of this activity. But no one was paying attention to us except us. It was effective for, you know, helping to raise money for Barack Obama. But again, once Obama became president, he started ignoring listening to people like us and started listening more to the normal D.C. beltway. And so what happened with Occupy, people rediscovered the power of physical presence. And even calling it Occupy is important. People showed up. And when people showed up and didn't go away, which had not been the norm in any progressive demonstrations, people started paying attention. And we completely shifted the political spectrum, or at least the perceived political spectrum in the country because of that.
But do you think that the Occupy movement was actually a function of the shortcomings of media, or do you think that there's just a online media, or do you think that it's more of there's an increased sophistication of the role of social media and of online activities with a generation that has grown up with it? I mean, you know, the conventional wisdom when blogging became really sort of on the scene in the early 2000s was that this was just a bunch of that it was young people, but in fact it was actually sort of people closer to my age and older who were sort of first embraced this medium. And I think to a certain extent these were people who not necessarily that found it to be an end in and of itself, but, you know, it was a technology that people had to change the way that they viewed this stuff. I mean, one of the biggest things that blogs had as a hurdle was a sort of conventional notion of legitimacy. And the idea that, you know, look, you're a blogger. Who are you? You don't have an editor. You don't have an institution behind you. And now that's sort of that's not an issue. Nobody, you don't hear people complaining that, you know, why are you following these people on Twitter? They have no editor or whatnot. I mean, people sort of now accept that there is something that is self-correcting and self-editing of social media. And there are less sort of like of these sort of more mundane issues that are dealt with, and that people understand now that it can be, how it can be used as a tool. I mean, because it seems to me, that it's not, that Occupy is not a reaction to social media. It is, in some ways, the integration of it as something that, you know, we're no longer looking under the hood. We're just using it.
Well, yes, we're using it, but also we're extending it, and we're actually going someplace.
Right.
Which before we were kind of all in driver's training and doing the driver simulation of democracy. And when we, and again, it was great for amongst ourselves, but we weren't reaching the rest of the country. We weren't reaching the rest of the world. And it really takes that kind of physical presence to draw both the TV cameras and the general population to pay attention to you. And just look at what the political spectrum was before people showed up on the streets and where it is now. And again, we had been doing the social networking part for on blogging for years. And it's great. It's a great tool. It's a, you know, I totally agree that it's essential to that digital democracy is really essential. In terms of having a common ground for all of us to be able to speak to each other and to be legitimate. But we also have problems with digital media that is false. We have problems with a lot of disinformation coming out and having a hard time verifying information.
So to the extent that you see some of these things as problematic, what are the solutions? How do we guard against these? Because is there much that we can do about the fact that we have, you know, just simply a handful of corporations that essentially control or have the ability to control our access to this information and therefore everything that we rely upon for that information?
Well, yeah, I think that a lot of it really comes to being, if we're going to start using technology, that we want to disintermediate a lot of the people and the companies that have been responsible for this. That if you think about the idea of Mozilla, the Firefox browser, it's not one company doing it. It's, or rather, it is a company doing it, but it's not a for-profit company. There's all the smart people, you know, all collaborating on this project, and it becomes something that everybody can use. There's no need for people to go and collect any data off of that. It would be great if Facebook followed the same model, that if it was an open model, it would act as a confederation. Just like you use email right now, you pick any email client you want to use, and you can send an email to someone. Rather than having to go through, say, AOL, which becomes the filter and the data collection service for all of that. So what I'd like to see is I like the technology. I want to see the business models around it change and move over to being really what I'd call a public option on most of this stuff, which would go and remove those companies from being part of the process. Similarly, I'd like to see the companies, the ISPs, like Verizon and AT&T, be pulled off of controlling access in every city. Because of the physical connection, most cities only have one way of connecting. So I'd like to see the rules change about ownership on that and people having options from picking more than one company.
And so, the latter being something that would obviously have to happen through regulation. I mean, how do you explain that? I mean, it's sort of surprising that there isn't a more of like an open source type of challenge to Facebook in some way, or is it simply that because Facebook is so easy, or has there been, and they just haven't been successful enough for me to know about it?
There actually is one that's called Diaspora, strangely enough, which really is an open and confederated model. It's still been very much in early stages, but the idea is that you own your own information, that it doesn't run on centralized servers, it runs on distributed servers, so that way there's not one point where all this data is collected. And then there's no arbitrators. There's no one saying that this is what you can do and can't do. And it becomes much more an open model, like we like about email and web browsers and that sort of approach. So it would be great to see social moving over from that. But right now, Facebook looks pretty ominous in terms of its intent. Because if you think about the timeline feature, do you really want that? Do you really want that much exposure? Think about kids and how much stuff they can expose, right, and how long and how persistent that information will be. You should be able to control what people see and what people are able to accumulate.
Jason Ben Levy. The book is Too Much Magic. You can go to jasonbenlevy.com to get more information. Thanks so much for joining us. Interesting stuff. Appreciate your perspective on this.
Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, some news of the day, of our era. Remember, later in the program, you can call in at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, or our Skype handle, Majority Live. I don't go on Facebook. I mean, Majority Report does. And I it's too much for me. I can't do it. All right. We got to take a break. We'll be right back after this.